Thank you very much, Tom. I asked him if he meant me. My name's Teresa Gresham. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. I am delighted to be here, and I'm very nervous with all these men sitting at my back. It really is great to be here. Did I tell you my name's Teresa Gresham? I'm an alcoholic. You did that already, right? I'm not excited or anything. I'm at home, and I know the sign up here was not made for me, but I took it for me. You're at home, and I'm sure that means to every one of us who's attending this AA meeting tonight. I've been here since late last Sunday night, and I've stayed in pretty much, except for one day I met a couple of friends for lunch, and then this morning I went to Sunday morning breakfast. And I've had the week visiting my daughter, and I think I was just really kind of recuperating from whatever I've been doing these last few years. And I've had a lot of opportunities to reminisce and think of a lot of things that have happened over these last 15 years, incidentally. The fire gave me 2 years I don't deserve. I had my 15th anniversary this past Tuesday. Now, before I go any further, I certainly want to thank Tom and Nate and Kenny for inviting me here to share with you this evening. It's a special privilege for me. And I want to congratulate the Allen Creek Eastman group that meet at Mary Haven. And that's a little hard for me to get used to because I still think of Mary Haven as in the old days. But I've thought a lot this week. The reflection came quite naturally to all the people here in Columbus who helped me get sober and helped me stay sober, as was read in our preamble of AA. And that's really what it's all about. I have some good information when I came to the fellowship. I've never forgotten it. It's very basic. And it's really helped me in good stead. It has allowed me to accept the challenges that came to me because I was sober. And as I've accepted those challenges, I've needed more and more to work a personal program for myself. The steps have become an absolute necessity for me. And I know, without getting into them to the best of my ability, as I came along, that I would not have been able to stay sober. I never could and never will be able to stay sober by myself. I have to have the other AA members share their strength, hope, and experience so that I can see myself for where I am at any given time. Left to myself, I'm really nothing. And I think that's part of our big book message. We hear it often in AA that we can do together what none of us can do alone. I used to tell a little joke, and I think I will in case anybody needs to relax, and maybe I need to a little bit. I had one joke that I told, and some people enjoy it. I don't know if most of you know that I come from West Virginia. It still shows, and it shows more in New York. The farther north I go, the more southern they think I am. Anyhow, it's about this rich couple who has made it in life, is very successful, and they decided to make a trip around the world, and in every country they visited, they wanted to do the thing to do in that particular place, and they did, and they traveled about, and they finally got to Africa. And in Africa, the thing to do was to go to a cannibal restaurant, and they did. And the waiter brought a menu, and they looked it over, and they saw that Englishmen were $50, Polacks were $105, and on down the line at the very bottom, West Virginia hillbillies were $350. And the husband, or the wife said to the husband, "Why did they charge so much for those West Virginia hillbillies?" And he says, "I don't know, but I'm going to find out." The waiter came back, and he asked him, he says, "Why do you charge so much for these West Virginia hillbillies?" And he looked down at him rather disgustedly, and he says, "Man, did you ever try to clean one of them?" Things? does pretty well. And what you see now is not what my children and my neighbors and the grocery people and those people in my neighborhood saw on weekends when I was drinking. I did pretty well during the week because I had a very important job and I was up front. I was expected as secretary to the president of one of the insurance companies here in Columbus. And many times I had important assignments where I would go in my boss's place to luncheons, etc. And I kept a pretty good front. And I think I was even pretty clean for a drunk because I had heard some expressions as I grew up that always stayed with me. And one of them was that cleanliness was next to godliness. And I didn't feel very godly, and I used to think I could at least be clean, and I had to for the sake of this job. And I think I used to try to wash it away. But the guilt was always there. I'll go back now a little bit and just tell you that I was raised in West Virginia, very uneventful, childhood, good, devoted, dedicated, religious parents. I was the oldest of four children. And I grew up a very good girl, actually. I was scared to death to be that. One thing that my mother said, I think, stayed with me for years, and it was her way of trying to scare me into being good. And she said that if I ever did anything to dishonor the family, they would disown me. And I think from the time I picked up the first drink, it appeared with an awful lot of guilt. And yet I tried to rationalize it away. I married a young man who was, by his own admission, already a full-fledged alcoholic. He had gone into the Merchant Marine right out of high school and quickly qualified for the program. He used to tell stories about being on Skid Row in New Orleans, New York, and other places where merchants, the Merchant Mariners ended up. And I didn't really know what all that meant, and I was very young. When people ask me how old I am now and ask me how old my children are, I'm tempted to lie about their ages, but all I say is that they get married very young. Anyway, I was married very young, and there was the alcoholism in the family right from the beginning. Our first child was born while we lived in West Virginia. She's here with me tonight, my daughter Kathy. And I didn't want to fail at marriage. It was a very important thing to me as a young girl. It was the one thing I wanted to do right. And I just hated it when it didn't work. When we had been married about 5 years, we moved to Columbus. And during that first year, our second child, Rob, was born. Fine little boy, and the last 5 years of that marriage probably should never have been. But I said often, and I still mean it, that I would do it all over again if it gave me the same results as far as the children were concerned. They were my whole life, and I think they were my security for a long time, possibly again qualifying for the program sooner because I do think I was destined to get here. Or destined to qualify. And because I loved them so much and they were my whole life, I jumped in and I was determined to keep this little family together. And I worked two or three jobs for the better part of 15 years in order to do that. This was the timing on this part-time work started before the divorce. When we'd been married just almost 10 years, the divorce came, and it was a matter of survival for the kids. I thought there might be a chance for them if the marriage finished, and that was the way it was. And I think it was what was destined to be, and I, in retrospect, still think it was the right thing. Because the kids grew up then with two alcoholic parents, as it turned out, and I never would have believed that it would be that way. I went to AA meetings with my husband in the winter months before we were divorced the following October. He was one of those people, I think, who didn't stay long enough to hear enough to make the right decision. So there are, and I'm sure there are some people here this evening who are young and sober. Stay long enough to hear enough so that you make the right decision. It's extremely important if you're an alcoholic that you get the help that is found here. And to give it a chance. I was much sicker than I thought I was when I came. And if you talk with the winners in the program, most people will tell you that you don't really get your head together until you've been in a little while. It just doesn't happen overnight. We didn't qualify overnight. And it's most of the time, I should only speak for myself, I didn't. Get on with my own qualification. There was a divorce, and for a couple of years, I don't even think I realized I was divorced. I was so busy, just holding the family together. There was a financial mountain decline, and I wanted to move the kids into a better neighborhood, and I was able to do that with all this extra work. And then I started qualifying, I think, in a very simple way, with having lunches with the office gang. I learned to like martinis. In the beginning, I drank them because of the large green olives. And later, I resented the size of the olives. And later, I didn't even bother with the glass or the olives. It was straight out of the bottle. And it didn't matter if it was a bottle that had been under the seat of the car on a hot parking lot all day, or if it was a bottle that I pulled out from under some ice trays in the refrigerator. It was still straight out of the bottle. I don't know how long it took for me to get to the point of alcoholic drinking. I really don't think it took too long. Yet when I came to the program, I thought I had a problem maybe for about a year. And the longer I stayed in, of course, and the better I got, the more the recovery came, I was able to look back and identify to earlier dates when I could see that I was in trouble. And the earliest date that I have been able to identify was in 1963 when President Kennedy was assassinated. I was home recuperating from foot surgery, both feet, and in a wheelchair. And my Uncle Bill, who was my ex-husband's relative, he used to stop by and bring a bottle of vodka on his way to take Aunt Edna up from one of the department stores where she worked. And while he was there, he would mix the drinks, and it was with Sprite. And to this day, I can't drink Sprite because it's too vivid. I still taste the vodka in. Anyway, he would mix it. And as soon as he left, then I didn't even bother with the Sprite or the glasses. These lunches had several sets of friends. I would go out two or three times a week with them. There would be the times when Uncle Bill would stop by. And then there were the times when, there was the first time when I went to buy a bottle of my own, and I went to the one that's here also in Grandview, about three doors from where I lived, and I bought the bottle of the orange screwdriver drink, the orange and vodka. And I never bought that bottle again. The next time it was the clear stuff, but it was the 42 proof stuff. And I always knew that once I went to the liquor store, it was going to be that much easier to go back again, and it was. Once I was into it, I had four staked out within a radius of 4 miles from where I lived and worked, and I was still seen too often. One time, one of those men in the liquor store over in Grandview said to me, "Never let your right hand know what the left hand is doing," and I really didn't know what he meant. Anyway, I was still seeing too often, and I was into alcoholic drinking. And I suspect that something like about 5 or 6 years that, for the most part, I really drank every day. Every day and every night by the time I came into the program. I sipped by day and gulped by night. I did maintenance drinking on the job. As I told you, I was secretary of the president of the company, and I had a lot of responsibility with the different assignments I had, and I had much respect from the people I worked for and with. And many of those people never suspected what was going on. I'm sure they must have smelled it, but I never did get bad on the job because I did that maintenance drinking. I know there were times when I wasn't challenged, times when I probably had had too much, but nothing was given to me at that particular time. And I would go into the restroom and, very quietly get into the stall and take a sip, and maybe that would hold me for 15 minutes or a half an hour. But I'd make it through the day, and then at night I'd fall apart. And yet all this time, I was still doing all this extra work, and I was speedy, and I was good, and I could deliver on the job. I don't know where I got the energy from. I guess, the real truth is that alcohol was saving my life at that time. That's how I was making it, because the alcohol kept me going. And I was young, and I was healthy, and I liked to work. It was never, I never felt a martyr at all in doing all of this. I thrived on what I was doing. But the day of reckoning, of course, as you know, was to come. It was going to turn around and be the other way. Alcohol was no longer going to be my friend and help me with this revival. And where was I going to be then? And at some point, I guess I knew, but I just didn't want to recognize the fact that I was really into it. I remember that I had pulled out the big book that had belonged to my ex-husband, and I tried to read it one time, and I'm sure I was trying to say to myself, you're not that bad yet. I read the book, I'll Cry Tomorrow, the Leon Ross story, and again, I'm sure I was trying to prove to myself somehow that I wasn't that bad yet. Well, I got that bad, and I still didn't know it. They call it a disease of denial, and in my case, I know that's true. It happened to anybody else, and I could understand it, and I knew AA was wonderful, because I had gone to those meetings with my ex-husband, and I loved the AA people. And yet, when I needed help, I really wasn't mentally capable of reaching out for help for myself. Someone else had to do that for me. I had worked for a number of years at a local pharmaceutical company, and the man who owned that company was my best friend over a number of years, and Lee used to talk to me from time to time about my drinking. I'd come in on Saturdays, I'm sure he could smell me coming through the door, and every time he would talk to me about it, I would thank him and then just immediately forget it. One Saturday I showed up and I was worse than I'd ever been, and he was angry with me and he said that I should go home and not come back until I felt better. And I was then angry with him, and I stomped out of there thinking I'm never going to feel that much better. And I thought he was nosy, he was into my business all the time. My sister also worked part-time at the plant, and I knew they were on my case and checking me out, and I resented that. What that gave me then was one more day to drink. Now I had all day Saturdays to drink, and so the drinking did get worse. I would get up on Saturday morning with the best intentions to do all those things that we working mothers or working wives intend to do on the weekend. There's the laundry and the groceries, and you're taking kids here and there. And it was my intention to do all those things, and I was always an early riser. And I get up, and I look at the bottle, and think I'm only going to have two. And the next thing I know, I would have blacked out, and the bottle would be empty. And I remember on one occasion, Kathy came down. She had been upstairs cleaning. She was a good little housekeeper all by herself. And she said, Mom, you look so tired. Why don't you go up to my room, it's all nice and clean, and you lie down and rest for a while. Well, I knew by that time, any time Kathy told me I looked that tired, that it was already showing. And if I had looked in the mirror, I probably would have seen the left lower lip lopping down, because that always happened to me physically. My lip just hung low on one side when I had too much. And so I went up to her room, and I laid down on the bed, flat on my back, and I looked at the ceiling, and I had my first hallucination. And it was a green skull with the crossbones. And I stared at it, and then when I looked back, it was gone. And there was another time when I was in my basement. I drank a lot in the basement. I did a lot of laundry. We also had the King's Laundry in town because it was a good place to hang out with the bottle. Probably wash the same clothes over and over again. But we had kind of a den fixed up in the basement, and I sat down on this old GF couch, and I get staring at the floor, and suddenly a long moss thing became a worm and started falling across the floor. Now, another time, and this was the worst of my hallucinations, and I think this was near the end of my drinking. I was driving to work one morning, and I used to go by way of Alley because my bottle would be empty, and I'd have to stop at the local carryout and get a bottle of that 42-proof stuff. And I'd anchor myself in the alleyway between garages and take my drinks out of the bottle going to work. But maybe that morning I hadn't had that because I think what was happening was that I was in withdrawal. I hadn't had enough. But at Matin and Third, I suddenly became aware that the light was red and that I should stop, but I didn't really care whether I stopped or not. And there suddenly appeared in the back seat another Rika. I was the one who was doing the physical thing of driving, and she was the one who was directing the show. And she told me everything to do all the way from there on to work, to parking the car, to pushing the elevator button, to going to my desk. And when my boss buzzed for me, she said, get the shorthand pad, and this is very true. And I was so amazed by it, I even told my boss. He said he was a genius of a man and a kind, wonderful, compassionate man. He probably knew what was wrong. But his comment was, don't worry about it, you'll get yourself together after a while. And the way I got myself together was when I went to lunch. I went to lunch and I had a couple of drinks and some silly sandwich, and then I was one person again. And I even called my doctor that day, and I had no idea what he said, but I even called my doctor about it. So that was the extent of the hallucinations, and I don't know how they might have gotten if I hadn't come into AA. Now, one more thing about the qualifications, if I remember I said this, and then on to what happened. I had found myself a dead-end street over in Grandview. It was my quiet place, my lonely place. It was my place where I think I was searching for some kind of serenity and peace. And it was also the place where I threw away all those drinking bottles that we never know what to do with. It was also a place on one hot summer day I discovered a berry patch. I was dressed in, I had white shorts on, and I hadn't gone out there planting thick berries. And I found these nice berries, and as I picked them, I threw them in the seat of the car. And then sat on them all the way home. But that spot was very meaningful to me, as I recall what it was like. Because every Sunday morning had gotten to be the same. Every day was the same, starting and ending with drinking and the maintenance during the day. But every Sunday morning, the bottle would be empty, and I had to go to the carryout and settle for 3-2 beer, and then get to my little place where I had to gulp it down. And this one particular Sunday morning, it was worse than it ever had been. I couldn't get there fast enough. I was shaking worse than I ever had. And I gulped that first can down, and then I grabbed hold of the wheel of the car, and I heard myself say out loud, okay, old girl, you're hooked. And what that meant to me at that time was that I couldn't stop drinking. I had to have it. It was my one weakness. I felt that I was so strong in so many ways, but I just couldn't handle this. I couldn't handle life without drinking. And even though I realized that, and incidentally, I was about 3 years sober before I realized what happened that morning, is that I took the first half of the first test. I admitted I was powerless over alcohol. And I had decided to live with it. So I wasn't capable of reaching out for help for myself, and I had to be a non-alcoholic. He made the call for me. My friend Lee at the pharmaceutical company was the person who made that call. Now, in the meantime, there was a crisis going on. There always seemed to be a lot of crises, but this was a heavy one. My boss, whom I idolized, came back from a vacation, and he was found to have cancer. And I had a terrible hang-up about death, and I didn't know how I was going to get through these months. I knew his family was Eli the Kennedy. I was just his secretary, and yet I didn't know how I could ever show up. You know, and one of my real immaturities was emotional, and particularly in this one area, because I never knew where that fear came from. I never have been able to identify it. I have, with growth in a program, been able to overcome it, thank God. It's one of the blessings. But I went to our medical director, and he prescribed some Neurosil for me. And I had never been a pill person, thank God, because I would have killed myself at a pharmaceutical company before I ever qualified for the program, because I used to pack all those goodies by the 5,000 in jars. But I was never into pills. And I took a prescription from the medical director to Lee to get a pill, and he knew the dangers of mixing alcohol and pills. And that's when he made the phone call to Hazel. I had met Hazel 9 years prior to this time, 10 years, I guess, when my husband was trying the program, and I never forgot her. Most people don't forget Hazel. I have met people all across this country who know that woman, incidentally. And she was known for her tough love, and it was exactly what I needed. You know, when I first came in, I thought, nobody is right all the time. And I still believe that today, incidentally. But I didn't get any bad information. I would say that she was probably 98.2% right. Anyhow, Hazel called me, and as I said, I hadn't forgotten her. And she said, I understand you might have a drinking problem. And I said, who says that I do? And she said, well, he thinks you might have. And I heard myself say, I ought to be mad at him, but I'm not. And I couldn't believe that I had said that. But that small pause between those two phrases where I guess I took my first inkling of an inventory, because I knew Lee made the call at the risk of my never working. In the meantime, I had gone back to work for him after that experience I told you about. But I knew he made the call at any risk, that I would never work there again, et cetera, et cetera. And I agreed to go to a meeting with Hazel. I thought I knew how it worked. And she had me come over to her house rather than her coming to mine. I told this story one time. She heard it, and she reminded me of why I did that. It was my idea, not hers. I didn't want my children to know. And she had me to come to her house. I went in, I sat down at her kitchen table, and stuffed in a plastic napkin holder were a bunch of AA Grapevines, the best little magazine in the world for alcoholics. And it's really ironic and fantastic that that was my first introduction to AA literature for myself, and that I ended up working with the best little magazine in the world for alcoholics. I was seeing Hazel in a different way this night because now I was an alcoholic myself. I had known her as the non-alcoholic spouse before. And she shared her story with me, and I began to identify. And it's that scene that is repeated so many times, over and over and over, in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. That scene where the recovering alcoholic is sharing with the still suffering alcoholic in a way that only we can communicate. And I agreed to go to a meeting with her on a a Thursday night. Actually, I agreed to go with her on a Wednesday night and called her and told her I couldn't. Said Robbie was playing ball, and I'm sure she thought I was going to drink. And I couldn't believe it that I didn't drink that day. I absolutely did not think I could go a whole day without drinking. It was fantastic that I did that. Because I had been at it around the clock, for so long, I didn't think it was possible. And I realize I'm saying it over and over again, that that's the way I felt. And I wanted to skip all over town when I realized that I'd made it a whole day. I was sure that she thought I would drink, but I didn't. And then I went to a meeting with her on Thursday night. We went to the Hilltop Group. I don't know if it's still going on. Good, I see somebody shaking their head. And there was a lady speaking that night. I had no idea what she said, and yet I thought I was together pretty much when I came here. I was much sicker than I thought I was. So many of you all who think you're together, and you aren't too far along in the program, stay and get more together. Because it takes a while. At least it did for me. And I say that seriously and because I care. But the only thing I got from that meeting that night were the words that somebody had written on a green chalkboard. The words said, "Hope is found here." And I was there, and I prayed with them, the beginning prayer and the closing prayer, and I didn't drink. At least I still went away with some hope. And it has almost gotten to be automatic, these things that I learned in those early days. I came in August of 69, and my sobriety date is February the 14th. No, I came in 68, and the sobriety date is February 14th, 69. So as I said earlier, I just celebrated the 15th of Tuesday. I should tell you that I drank twice, once when I was 6 weeks in the program, and once at 6 months, and that was the last one. Neither time was it very much, and neither time no more than 2 hours, but each time meaningful. And I'm going to take the time to tell you about it. I know many people have definite opinions on slips, and that's their right. I sometimes wonder if people who have such definite opinions ever had one. Now, I had two. And neither time, in my own mind, as clear and as sane as I can think, was I aware of any premeditation. It was not planned. Now, I'll give it this much. It could have been subconsciously. But as far as I'm concerned, as honest as I can be, after 15 years in the program, I was not aware of any planned drunk. I did not want to get drunk, and I was going to meetings every night. The realization that I got from this first experience the first experience got me another level. I had never been picked up by the police. I had not changed my ways that much yet at 6 weeks in the program. It takes a while, as I said before. I had arranged to meet somebody in Lancaster. I came home from work at 5 o'clock, and my wonderful, beautiful daughter, Kathy, who was such a wonderful, beautiful house cleaner, had her times when it wasn't that way. And this was one of those days, and I suppose I was looking for an excuse to act like a child myself and throw a tantrum. But when I walked in the back door, the iron board was up. The peanut butter jar open, a knife stuck down in the peanut butter jar, crackers all over the place, and I had a tantrum. Stormed out the back door, went to the carryout. I didn't even get the high-powered stuff. I got the 42-proof vodka. A fifth of it, and I drove to Lancaster. I guess I drank half of it on the way. I had apple pie and ice cream while I was there. And on the way back, I guess I killed off the bottle. But driving out Good Hill, very close to where I live, I suddenly realized my brain was crystal clear. It had never been that clear. And if it ever gets that clear again, I'm going to be scared to death because in what seemed like the very next instant, was kind of coming out of a blackout. I'm in the Grandview police station, and this big Italian cop looking down at me saying, "Lady, you better find somebody to call, or you'll spend the night and you'll still have to call somebody in the morning." And I didn't know what had happened. They had taken me about 50 yards from my own home in the middle of the street honking the horn. Just like saying, "Come and get me, you know, I'm trying to take me to the police station." You know, and I tried to figure that out. I tried to rationalize that maybe there was an animal in the way. Maybe somebody tried to get into my moving car. And then I got honest. I was drunk, and I had reached another level. Now, that's what the first experience gave me. At 6 months, my boss died. I had gone to the funeral, never shed a tear. I was 4.5 months in the program when that happened. And I couldn't believe that either. You know, I actually showed up, and I didn't cry. And it was wonderful that I got through this, but that little bit of time in the program, I had grown so much. And I'm not sure what happened to cause this next experience, but what I remember is that the man who came to rescue me, who came to my aid the night that I was caught the first time, was a prosecuting attorney in Columbus, and he had been one of the officers at my insurance company. So that night when I was troubled, he was the person that I had called to come and tell me. He's the only person I knew who would be willing to put up $100 for me. And so, you know, then his wife had died, and at a weak moment, I had invited him to come to my house for dinner. And I made a big deal out of it. He would have been happy to sit on the back steps and have Colonel Sanders' chicken, but I knew he had all the fine china, and I didn't have all that, and I just became very frustrated, I guess, and out looking for groceries and with the intent to find some Faygo Diet Pop for Kathy and filling up the car with gasoline. I'm looking at the carryout, and I go in to get the Faygo Diet Pop, and they don't have it, but they still have that 42-proof vodka. And I came out with a pint of it, went home, preparing the dinner, and halfway through the dinner, and halfway through that pint, I got a phone call, and he wasn't coming after all, he had diarrhea. And I've had my second slip. Now, Hazel, I had heard Hazel say, "There's kind of a new person in the program, call me before you have that drink." And I was scared to death of her, and I didn't want to call Hazel. So I called Bob from the east side, Bob M., many of you know him, and Bob became my co-sponsor, but I didn't intend to tell Bob what happened, I just knew I ought to be in touch with somebody. So I called, and he said, "Hi, Rita, how are you?" And I said, "I'm not very good." And he came over, and we talked, and we went out and got coffee, and I came right back to the program. Now, what came to me with that experience, and I hope it's my last, really was the first step. In the third chapter of the big book, the last paragraph, it speaks about the time will come in an alcoholic's life when we may not be able to refrain from reaching out and having that first drink. And we better have enough God's power at that time to rescue us. Those are my terms for what's said there. I've never tried to quote it verbatim. So I haven't had to fight that battle since. I think at least 10 minutes ago I was going to tell you that one other experience of me through with the qualifications. I suspect you believe that I earned the right to be here. I do, and I guess that's all that's important. A non-alcoholic gave me this opportunity because this lady Hazel had known him, and the message was carried, and then I had to be responsible for my own sobriety. I was told how it worked, and it worked real well, and we were told how it works with this. Very clearly, it tells us how it works. These are the steps we took. When I heard how it worked read the first time, I must have heard it several times, but I finally heard it good, and that was my challenge. It said there was a chance for me if I was capable of being honest with myself. And as I thought about that, I knew nobody else knew about me. And I didn't know it all because there had been many blackouts. And so I was as honest as I could be for that time, and it has continued to be that way. There was a lady here for a while from California, her name was Laverne, and she talked about how we come into this program with layers and layers of self-deceit, and it all doesn't come off overnight. And that's certainly true. But I have to be as honest as possible, and I have to keep me clean inside, feeling good about myself, or I truly think I couldn't make it. I cannot make it by myself, and I have to be right with me every day. When I get in trouble, I really have to clean it up pretty fast, whether it's my fault or another party. I can't be that uncomfortable anymore. I love being myself, and I like seeing other people come in and grow in the program. And as I said earlier, my program is still pretty much the way it was in the beginning. It has to be very basic. Hazel said, if I wanted what I found here, I had to be willing to give it away. And that's why I'm here tonight. I made a commitment to AK. And she told me the only way to win this battle was to give up. And so I guess with that second experience of drinking in February 69 that I literally surrendered to this. And so far, one day at a time, I've been able to make it. I got active at the group level, and I look back and I remember at 2 years in the program, I was secretary of my group. I was still getting lost. I was supposed to bring the cookies, and I get there and the meeting would be started. And I'm 2 years sober, and I'm a pretty high figure in my office and responsible, but I was still quite the hell. You know, so it takes a while, believe me. And I still do dumb things, you know, and now I can laugh at myself when I do. I do still get lost. I sure do. And I'm glad that I no longer have to consider myself superhuman. I used to think I had to be perfect. Today I know that's not possible. And I've earned the right to be myself, whatever that is, at any given time as I trust this road to our happy destiny. I got active in the group. I also got active with the Pyramid Club. I thought that was going to be a temporary thing. Darcy, who was in charge of the club, induced me into coming in to help out, and then he left town. And I looked around, and there was Jerome, and he left. We had started a group meeting there, and we, for the longest time, struggled to keep that club together, and it's very important. We saw a lot of people come in there and hang out who didn't have any place else to go. I had a decent home to go to, and I didn't have to be at the club. But it meant something to a lot of people, and it meant a lot to me, just sharing. And I look back on those days, those early days here in Columbus, when it seemed things were different, but it's really that things were in different places, like Mary Haven was out on East Broad Street. We took the ladies to Mary Haven to be rehabilitated, and I moved the men and out of there, and one person kind of lived with me from there one time. And I look back at those experiences as good ones. Those club experiences are funny, a lot of them. I take my pots and pans down full of home-cooked stuff, and we put on dinners, and then I get mad about something, and I take all my empty pots home, and I quit, and the very next week I brought it back again. I made some wonderful friendships during that time. There are a lot of them, and if I start naming names, I'll get in trouble because there are a lot of them here tonight. but I just have to say something about my good friend Jerome. You can never put your sobriety in the hands of one other human being. I think it has to be with God as I understand him, and I have to be responsible for it. But we have the good fortune sometimes to have the right people cross our paths at the right time. And he helped me so many times. He knew when I was in trouble, many times before I knew I was in trouble. He could read me that well. And even after I moved to New York, I'd get calls from Kathy where she needed a little rescue, and she would help out there. My children, because we knew each other all these years. I remember one time Rob was in trouble about something. He said, "Don't tell Jerome." And it was just that kind of friendship. I remember Paul Nunley, you know, who was a good friend, and many other people that I met here. And some of them are no longer around. I've had the opportunity to meet and work with some of the finest people in the world. But I'll tell you, I haven't met any better or any more decent or honest people than the sober people and this fellowship. And I treasure that more than anything. Why shouldn't I? It gave me my life. By myself, I am nothing. With the help of the friends who have been able to stay sober and help get me and keep me sober, I have been able to make it one day at a time, and it's mutual all the way. We help each other. And it's so important to remember that. And it all comes down to honesty. I must be honest with me, and I have to recognize where I am, and I have to be willing to take that inventory a friend might take for me sometimes. Jerome used to do that. He would give me hell for all of this stuff I was doing. And I'd say, "I'm meeting myself coming back." And he'd say, "You're going to get drunk. You're doing too damn much, you know." And I'd say, "I don't have to take my inventory. You take it for me." Well, that really wasn't true. In the end, I always had to take it. But I had that wonderful experience here in Columbus, Ohio, and because of you and those people who were there then, I have been given a wonderful opportunity to serve an entirely different way. It is a great joy that I never expected. There's another man in this room tonight who has a lot to do with where I am today. I said I got active at the group level, and then with also with the club, and then somebody pushed me into general service. I didn't want to be there. I was happy in my own group. I had enough to do. And Betty said, "We can't find anybody to stand for secretary. We need somebody with your talent." And she had pushed me for a couple of years, and finally I said, "Okay." And I went to the quarterly meeting, and with no competition, they elected me area secretary. We had a delegate who believed in delegating, and he gave me a lot of experience during those 2 years. We had a conference, and but I still didn't have much experience. We had some bad luck during that time. Our chairman died. My friend Betty, who had become the alternate delegate, drank again, and our treasurer had borrowed our state conference funds. I was getting the harassing phone calls at my insurance company. The group came together, and that was all paid off. And they looked around at election time the following year, and they said, well, somebody had asked me if I'd stand for chairman, and I said I really didn't think I was qualified. And then I ran into Oscar over at the Westland meeting, and he said, "Yes, you stand for delegate." And I said, "I don't think I'm qualified." And he said, "Well, if you get the job, you'll know what to do with it." And so I did, and they did, and I was elected delegate, and I served 2 years, and he said, by the 1976. And during those 2 years at the conference, I served on the conference Grapevine Committee. And the people at the Grapevine got to know me. And in February of 1977, I received a letter from the man who was the editor at that time asking me to come to New York to be interviewed for the job that I now hold. And it was their intention right from the beginning to make me the managing editor. The managing editor had retired and they had not replaced her. Now, I didn't know when I went there with all this confidence. I never doubted that I could do the job, honest to God, didn't. I didn't know they had three other people in there ahead of me who had come and gone. I found that out after I got there. But I walked in and I loved it right from the beginning, and I had had the kind of business background that was right for this. Every experience I had on a job from the time I had started my career had come into play at that office. I've had many, many wonderful experiences because you guys in Columbus, Ohio helped me get sober. I'll tell you about one, at least this one, and then I'll finish this off. I had for years wanted to go to a little island in the Caribbean where my friend Lee had gone years before that. And he built a drugstore on this little island, the first drugstore there. And he thought it was paradise on earth. And he had said he wanted me to have that opportunity to come back in time. Lee was killed when I was 3 years in the program, and that's a real part of my story, too. But after I went to work at the Grapevine, I've been there a couple of 3 years, and I was able to get the money together and go down there. And when I came back from that vacation to New York, somebody was supposed to go to Alaska for a regional forum we were putting on. And he couldn't go, so he asked me to go in his place. So I went to Alaska. And I came back. The West Virginia State Committee had decided that it was going to rotate its meetings around and take their quarterly meetings. And they had invited me to come. And they were holding at that particular time in Logan, West Virginia. And that's where I was raised. And that's where Kathy was born. And I went there. I had been there for 23 years. And it truly was an emotional experience. I could walk out of this building, look over on the hillside, and see the little white house where I lived. It's 23 years prior to that time. And I realized that my life was beginning to fall apart at that time, and it really hadn't even started. And it was truly an experience. But what it did for me was to remind me of where I came from and what AA had done for me. I never had any dreams ever in my life of living in New York City. I used to dream of leaving the country a lot, but never had that experience that many young girls have. And because somehow God and His wisdom spoke to a non-alcoholic who knew an AA member by the name of Jason, who was willing to carry the message to me and help show me the way. And then all of you all were there to help me, day at a time, make it. I have been given these privileges. It's a joy to work at the Grapevine. We have the sharing from members all over the world, people just like you, to write the magazine. And it's a magazine that deals with coping with sober living. And a lot of times in the wee hours of the morning, when you're maybe afraid to make that phone call to somebody, and if you have a little magazine, you've got all those members talking to you. Now, it's not my idea to come here and sell you on the magazine, but if you want to buy it, we have it for sale. So, again, I want to thank the committee for inviting me here. I brought a lot of wonderful members to me, and I'll just close with the way I used to close when I lived here. It has to do with a little story about a coal mining engineer, a little office that I worked in when I was back in West Virginia, much younger, just beginning my way. Mr. Benners, who was about to retire, said to me one day, "Rita, remember that your fast is coming where you're going to be." And I knew what he was telling me. I thought his life was about over at 65, and he was telling me to make good use of my time, because one day I would be where he was. And I thought about that from time to time, and when I came into the program, it came back to me again, and I was connected with this disease of alcoholism, and how unknowingly I was fast becoming what I was going to be, to that point where I was alcoholic and had no longer any control over it and couldn't be responsible for my behavior. I became an alcoholic, and through God's grace, I was granted the privilege of getting sober, and that for the rest of my life, one day at a time, with the 12 steps of the program, I could become whatever I was going to be from that point on. And that's a powerful message for me. And if it can help any of you, I'd like to leave that thought with you too. That you too are fast becoming what you're going to be. And I hope that it will be sober and happy and continuous. Thank you, and I love you all.